On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Very often in the church, we hear the phrase that we are called to some task. Often we think of people who lead music in church or who paint beautiful paintings that adorn the walls of the church. We think of them as the sort of the official creative people of the church. That's their gifting, and God has called them to be artists. But actually, when we think this way, we're limiting the work of the Holy Spirit, empowering all of us to be artisans. And to tell us more about that idea, and develop that idea much better than I have done so in this little introduction, is Erwin Raphael McManus. He is the author of The Artisan Soul, Crafting Your Life into a Work of Art, from Harper One, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Erwin is a cultural pioneer for his integration of creativity and spirituality, author of a number of books that have been reviewed on BookBits and on the bookshelf, and has a BA in psychology from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Masters of Divinity from Southwestern Theological Seminary, Doctorate of Humane Letters from Southeastern University. And he is the founder of Mosaic, a community of faith in Los Angeles, known for its innovative creativity and artistry. Mosaic has been named one of the most influential and innovative churches in America. Erwin, thank you so much for being with us today on the bookshelf.
Oh, it's great to be here with you.
When you first started putting this book together, was it as a result of hearing that phrase over and over, well, that's just not my gift, I'm not a creative person?
Well, it really was, for me, hugely connected to people constantly being shaped by the voices that told them what they could not do and who they were not, rather than the voices that told them who they were and what they could accomplish in life. And if you think about all the different important virtues in life, you know, someone may have, like, let's say, the gift of teaching, but we all want to teach. We want to teach our children. We want to teach the wisdom we've learned. We all, you know, maybe we don't all have the gift of service, but we all want to serve. We may not all have the gift of mercy, but we all want to be merciful in life. And one of the strange things to me is that we take the most important aspect of being human, this God-given inherent creativity, this ability to imagine and create, and say, no, that's only for the painter or the dancer, when really every day of our lives should be a work of art.
I love this idea. I'm going to quote you here. Creativity is the natural result of spirituality. Being creative means that we are doing what God did in the very beginning. To me, creativity is an expression of that, of the fact that we are formed by God, His Spirit is breathed into us, and that we are a very special creation of God. And I think we are made in His image, and I think that imagery is a number of things, but one of them, key, is creativity, that we are created to create.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that is so important is we are created in the image and likeness of God, and we understand that aspect of it when it comes to our character, that we're supposed to reflect the character of God. But what we didn't realize is that our character is the material from which we create our lives and we create the world around us, and that God imagined us before He created us, and we were imagined to imagine. We were created to create. That God gave us this beautiful gift of the imagination where we can dream, we can form ideas, thoughts, we can have visions of the future. And then when we find the courage and the passion, we start taking on the disciplines and skills, and we actually translate those ideas into real life.
Now, of course, as you point out in the book, The Artisan Soul, creativity is not without risk. To create is to reflect the image of God, Erwin writes. To create is an act of worship, but we cannot create without risk. Is the fear that we are going to be a failure, that and therefore held up to ridicule or pity, is that one reason that people are not as creative, or is it just as simple as we don't expect everybody to be creative, so we don't require it of them?
I think it's a combination of being told all of our lives we're not creative, being told that only people like Picasso or Michelangelo are creative, not valuing the creative beauty of everyday life, and then on top of that, the risks that are involved in creating. Whenever you create, you're taking a risk of being criticized and critiqued. I mean, to me, as a parent, one of the things that strikes me the most is there a greater risk than giving life to a child? And is there a greater risk than pouring your life into that child and raising them and hoping that they become, you know, the best expression of themselves and living in fear that you know, they may make destructive choices in their life? And I don't know if there's a greater risk than when you create out of love. And that, to me, is the central challenge of the artisan soul. That to create takes great courage, because it takes great courage to live the life that God created you to live.
I love in this passage, art is its in its purest form is an extension of the soul. That is exactly what life is supposed to be. In other words, art is not just something that we do if we happen to be one of those fortunate few that is creative. Art is a description of the life that we live. I love this idea of life lived well as a work of art, and a work of art that is dedicated to the glory of God. This is an amazing image, not just for people who are normally thought of as creative, musicians and fine artists and so forth, but everybody.
Absolutely. My greatest concern with the title, The Artisan Soul, is that people will think the book isn't for them because they're not artisans, because in their mind they're not creative, because they're not artists. My wife, when she asked me about the book, I said, it's going to be called The Artisan Soul. She said, well, great, a book for people like you who are creative, but what about the rest of us? And that's exactly why I wrote the book, because my wife is so creative. My wife has such an amazing imagination. She just runs circles around me, but she has all these voices inside of her that tell her that she's not creative, that she's not an artisan, and that she can't live her life as a work of art. And so this book really is to try to convince every person that you are a work of art and an artist at work. You're a work of art because you are a masterpiece of God, and you're an artist at work because God has created you to do something in this world that reflects the beauty of who He is.
Now, that brings up two thoughts from the book, and they're related. One is that we have robbed certain words of their power. That is, good, it just seems like a gradation, not quite as important as great. That's point one. And the second is that we tend to think of artisan as someone who has a particular skill, and sometimes we look askance at someone as an artisan versus a craftsman or a craftsperson, I suppose. Both of those are language problems, I think, and that you've expressed that very well in the book.
You know, sometimes when we overuse words, they lose their value, and then sometimes they change the arena in which you use that word. And when we have the contrast between, let's say, good and great, and Jim Collins wrote an amazing book called Good to Great, and we look at the business context, it makes perfect sense. I understand exactly what he's saying. But the difficulty, though, is that good ends up becoming a secondary word when it really is categorically a different description. Great is about the end product, but good is about the essence of that product. And so in the scriptures, when God creates, it says, it was good, it was good, it was good, it was very good. It doesn't say it was great, even though it was great. It should say it was magnificent, it was awesome. But God finishes each movement of creation with, it was good, because everything that God creates is reflective of His essence, and everything we create is reflective of our essence. And this is important for us to understand, that every day we're creating an expression of what's inside of our souls.
I think it's so important that you've got a poem in here that's called Where the Echoes Stop. And this is inspired, I'm thinking, by because it ends with a quotation from Psalm 46. Do you want to share the poem with us? Or?
Well, I can't recite the poem, and I'll let you pick up the book and read it.
Okay.
But I wrote that poem about 20 years ago. And it was really born out of this, I think, painful realization that most of us spend our lives being echoes rather than finding our voice. That so many times, because we want to be loved, we want to be accepted, we want to be affirmed, we end up simply repeating back what we know other people want us to say. We say what they want to hear. and we become a part of an echo rather than hearing what God is really saying to us, what he's calling us to, and being the unique human being that God created us to be. And so that poem is really about, don't let yourself become a part of the noise. Don't let yourself become an echo. Find that inner voice that guides you. Hear what God is calling you to, the life that he wants you to live, the person he wants you to become, and have the courage to live out that voice.
We are talking today, in case you're just joining us, to Erwin Raphael McManus, the author of The Artisan Soul, Crafting Your Life into a Work of Art. It's from HarperCollins, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. It's Harper One, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. In The Artisan Soul, you talk about the relationship with those between those who live most freely and those who dream the most. You say, captivity not only steals our freedom, but it cripples our imagination. What you're talking about here is not just physical slavery, although it certainly is inherent in that, but even more deeply, we're not really slaves unless we give in to the feeling that we are hopeless and that we cannot imagine anything better than what we're enduring.
Absolutely. You know, when I spent 10 years working with urban poor, I knew people were going to be lacking shelter and food and clothing. But what I didn't realize is that poverty has a very brutal and tragic way of destroying our dreams. And so many times I would interview young people trapped in poverty and ask them, where would you like to see your life go? Who would you like to become? What kind of career would you love to have? And because their opportunities had been so limited, they've lost their capacity to imagine a life different than the one that was trapped in poverty. And you have to rebirth the power of the dream, because you can give a person opportunity. But if they don't have the belief that their life can be different, it can be better, they're not going to seize that opportunity at all.
There's a wonderful portion where you contrast two of my favorite painters, and that's Vincent van Gogh's work and Monet's work. And you talk about how van Gogh's narrative is a journey of inner turmoil, but Claude Monet is a translator of beauty. Seem to remember, I believe it's Monet and not Manet, but it seemed to remember that at some point in his life, Monet had cataracts, and the colors of his paintings began to change slightly because he painted the way he saw things. Then when he had the cataracts fixed, he was overwhelmed by how vivid the world was, and his paintings from that point forward take on a new kind of energy and a new kind of life. But even before he had the cataracts taken off, the type of works that he was producing was so very different than the kind of painting that Van Gogh was doing.
That's a great observation about his life. In fact, I was just with a friend a few days ago and telling him, I normally wear glasses, and, I'm supposed to wear glasses, but I normally don't wear them, and I forget how detailed leaves are. I think I'm looking at trees, but I'm really looking at shadows that I've identified my mind as trees. And think about how that applies to life. And with all the talent Monet had, his talent elevated to an entirely different level once he saw life clearly, once he saw the world clearly. I mean, what are the implications for us when we don't take the time to look and see and perceive life as clearly as we should, to see all the opportunity and wonder and beauty all around us? I mean, how much more creative and optimistic would we become if we could see with a new lens, a clearer lens?
I think it's important, too, that we realize that God is weaving us into the story of the world. And therefore, our lives have meaning. We were not an accidental creation. We are a deliberate creation of God. And he created us uniquely. And therefore, our lives have value more than just showing up each day. And that we need to discover what it is that we bring to the tapestry. What we need to discover our voice, as you've written in here.
You know, one of the great challenges is when you have to go to work each day to a job that may feel so mundane and so standardized, and it can suck the life out of you. It can, in a sense, almost like begin to kill your soul. And one of the most important things to do is whatever job you have, and I try to tell people, look, work is honorable. But whatever work you have, if it's good work, then do good work and bring your best self there. Wake up in the morning and ask yourself, how can I create a more optimistic and more positive environment? Even if the job itself feels mundane, when you begin to care about the people around you, when you begin to invest in the people you work with, when you bring hope and joy and compassion to the room, you begin to change the entire environment of work.
There's a passage in the book where you talk about that truth only exists if someone is trustworthy. That's such a powerful thought. The truth is an extension of someone who can be trusted. The truth exists because God is trustworthy, unquote. I think this is such a powerful thing for us to remember, especially in this time when there seems moral relativity seems to be kind of infecting not just the culture, but even the culture within the church and within the body of Christ. We need to remember that the reason that we can trust God is because he is trustworthy, and that there is such a thing as truth because God is trustworthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the challenge, though, is that many times we try to prove that truth exists through arguments and through debate as if truth were data or information. But really, truth is relational. The truth that really matters is the truth that connects people together, connects us to God. And so it's less important to go, is Pluto a planet or not? When we decided it wasn't a planet, it didn't really change anything for us.
True.
But it's far more important, the truth that I say to my wife, that I'll always be faithful to you. And I think sometimes we try to act as if all truth is flat, but the reality is the truth that matters is the truth that's reflective of our character, of our essence. And that's why it's so important to remember the truth exists because God can be trusted.
I want to go back to Van Gogh for just a minute because he kind of typifies what so many people sort of generalize artists to be, that they have to have this tragic life in order to create great art. There's a certain element to that, but only because everyone suffers. And one way that we have of that God uses that God redeems our suffering is to use us to be an expression of that, to bring that into art and the way that we live our lives, right?
Absolutely. Everyone suffers, but not everyone reflects. And I think the reason so oftentimes we see great works of art from those who suffered is because they stopped to reflect on their experience and their pain. And then when life is going well, when our life is filled with optimism and hope and joy, we have a tendency to not stop and reflect, which I think is called worship, and allow that experience of awe to shape us. I long for us to reflect as deeply on beauty as we do on tragedy, and to see what kind of awe-inspiring work will emerge out of that.
That reminds me of a quote that you have in here from Albert Einstein. There are two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle, and the other is as if everything is a miracle. Interpretation matters.
Absolutely. And if you bring into each moment the pain from your past, unforgiveness, bitterness, if you bring in anger and disappointment, then every moment in your life is going to be interpreted through that pain. But even if you've been through that pain, if you bring in hope and optimism, if you bring a love that's more powerful than betrayal, a hope that's more powerful than despair, then you begin to see all the wonder and possibility and opportunities that are in the moment you're in and in the future you're stepping into.
And that goes back again to realizing that we are created to create, and that the creative act is a manifestation of imagination.
Absolutely. If you keep looking back, you're using all of your imagination for regret, and you need to start looking forward and use your imagination to create.
There's a discussion in the book you talk about. You were invited to be a part of a discussion panel at Columbia University in New York City, and the subject was, what can be known? You enjoyed being on the panel. You were asked by someone in the crowd, when you were a child, you had imaginary friends like Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and God. Why did you get rid of the other imaginary friends and keep God? And you say, even now, I still love this question. And I was when I read that just had gotten that far, I thought, okay, I want to see how he answers this, because I've been asked questions similar to that myself. I would love to see how you discuss that with someone without making it sound like you're so stupid for asking me such a silly question. Those are imaginary and God's not imaginary. Don't ask me any more questions. Because that's the temptation is for us to respond to a question like that with great defensiveness. What do you mean imaginary? And yet you dealt with it with a great sensitivity and with a sense of joy in how you answered it. Do you remember?
Yeah, I have to be honest. I don't see that as a stupid question. I think it's a really honest question.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it is inside of our imagination that all of those ideas exist, whether it's Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. And that is one of the things that is always tricky, isn't it, as a parent, to go, you know, what things do I let my children believe when they're little? Because later I have to tell them they're imaginary, that they're not real, that they're myths or fables. And what we need to realize is that we don't need to be afraid of that, because God is the God who gave us the imagination. And just because we can have imaginary friends that we create doesn't mean there isn't a God who created the imagination who is also our friend. That he created our imagination, because without it, we would have no place to be able to interact with him. I mean, how in the world can a God who is all-knowing, all-present, all-powerful, find a space to be able to have even the smallest interaction or conversation with us? The imagination is that one place where we exist, in a sense, without limit. We can actually interact with God and experience him most deeply.
And let's face it, being honest, we have not seen God. We believe God. We believe in God. We believe that one day we will see him, that he became incarnate in Jesus and walked the earth for 33 years and then went back to heaven, and that one day he'll come again to claim us. But except for those extraordinarily rare circumstances where people have visions of God or something, we don't really know what God looks like. So when we're praying, when we're having a dialogue with God, imagination is a critical part of that, for us to know that we are speaking to a real person who is listening to us, who wants to listen to us. I think just the fact that the creator of the universe desires more than anything else to be in communication and in relationship with each one of us is the most extraordinary thing ever.
Absolutely. And honestly, it's no different than the way we relate to each other as well, because when you're speaking, those sounds are actually provoking images in our imagination. When I say elephant, your brain imagines an elephant. You know, when we talk about love, our imagination carries that. And we're designed by God to interact with the universe through our imagination. It's how a small child is designed. You have to teach a child to read and write. You have to teach a child to count and, you know, to add, subtract. But you do not have to teach a child to imagine. It's what humans do inherently and naturally.
There's one more passage I wanted to bring up. Or maybe a concept that you have in here, and that is there's a tension in among musicians. Say I can speak of this because I'm a musician in church as well as just a musician overall. That is we're told in the Psalms to make a joyful noise before the Lord, not once but several times. And yet we're also told that and we also understand that we should bring our best efforts to God. And you address that. A couple of sentences here I want to quote. The best way to produce your best work is to surround yourself with people who are committed to always bringing their best work. There's a critical process that demands our highest engagement and execution if we are to achieve optimal performance. And then on the next page, I'm absolutely convinced that a spiritual gift and hard work were never intended to be mutually exclusive. To do our greatest work, we must overcome the temptation to be afraid or discouraged, engage in the creative process with strength and with courage. That's a powerful thing to hear because it reminds us that whatever we bring to the Lord, it should not be our second best. It should never be the calf that has two weird eyes or the cow that was going to die anyway. The Old Testament, you couldn't bring an unworthy sacrifice to the Lord. But I think that in these days, we don't need to bring anything but our best to the Master.
Yeah, absolutely. I you know, those two passages you're dealing with are saying so different things. Making a joyful Lord a sound or noise to the Lord is talking about our unashamed love and worship of God. But it doesn't mean that we're supposed to be doing that publicly or on stage. And I think so many times we've had a diminished value for the quality of the work that we do in God's name. I mean, if we do anything in God's name, it should be the best that we can do. And we should aspire to be the best in the world. And I love that. I mean, I love when Solomon talks about that this needs to be magnificent, the temple, that it's going to be the best because our God is greater than all the other gods. I mean, Solomon couldn't even imagine a world where he should create something that wasn't the best if God's name was going to be on it. And that's the way we should think. When Jesus turned the waters of the wine, it was the best wine in the world. It wasn't average wine. It wasn't, you know, supplemental. It was the best that has ever been created.
Right. And as you write, what will we expect except for God to make the very... How could Jesus have made mediocre wine? Because that's not his nature. His nature is to make things the very best they can be.
Yeah, absolutely. And think about how magnetic it would be if we as followers of Christ were committed to being the best at whatever we do, the best teachers, the best architects, the best doctors, the best lawyers, the best administrators. If we were the best in the world and we were committed to be the best we could be, I am so convinced that by itself would draw the world into a conversation about who Jesus is.
Irwin, it's always a pleasure to read your books. I really enjoyed this one and got such a great deal out of it. Planning on sharing it with some of my friends and colleagues in the Christian music world, as I told you before. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that you wanted to bring up that I neglected to ask you?
Well, no, but I would love to let people know that I have a website, IrwinMcManus.com, if people want to come get more information or see some of our work or even access the book. We also have a podcast at mosaic.org that is free. It goes out to the world. We have about 500,000 people every week who download our podcast. And I'm going through the series with Artisan Soul right now, book clubs all over the world. And then we do a 3-day immersion called Terra Nova on Labor Day weekend that focuses on awakening the creative spirit, that really focuses on this entire process of living out your artisan soul. And if people want to know more about those, they can go to the mosaic.org website or to the IrwinMcManus.com. And we just want to be part of a new conversation about who God is, who Jesus is, who we are, to let people know that God is the master artist who created us and imagined us, and that we are his work of art, and that all of us are to be artists at work. And for me, this is an exciting time in history.
Absolutely. Irwin McManus, our guest today on the bookshelf, his new book, The Artisan Soul, Crafting Your Life into a Work of Art. It's from Harper One, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Irwin, thank you so very much for joining us today on the bookshelf.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Hey, God bless you, bro.
Hey, God bless you too. Once again, those websites, mosaic.org for the podcast. You can check his website at Irwin McManus. That's IrwinMcManus.com. Thanks so much for joining us on the bookshelf today. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thank you so much for joining us, and God bless.